This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
How far up are we going?
Not too far.
Okay. It's a massage.
Grace McKinnon is 68 years old. She lives in senior housing in Chelsea, Massachusetts. And that warm, wonderful laugh comes as she swirls a cotton swab in her nose and is then shown how to dunk the swab into a plastic vial.
Put the swab into the liquid here.
Okay.
And mix it up. Squeeze it out. And we'll dispose of the swab.
Okay.
Grace is getting a COVID rapid test. But unlike many other Americans, she didn't have to wait in line for hours or scramble from pharmacy to pharmacy to find that rapid test. Grace didn't even have to leave her senior housing building.
Easy. I was on the fifth floor. I came down to the first floor, walked down a hallway. That was it.
The free rapid tests are being offered by the Chelsea Project, a nonprofit working to reduce the spread of COVID in this Massachusetts city. Chelsea is one of the most densely populated urban areas in the country. More than 40,000 people live within just a couple of square miles. More than 60% of them identify as Hispanic, and more than 80% of the adults in the city are categorized as essential workers. All of which is to say, back in the earliest weeks of the pandemic, Chelsea got hit hard. In April 2020, the city had one of the highest infection rates in the entire nation, six times higher than the Massachusetts state average, and even more than the infection rate during the worst days of 2020 for New York City. Which is why now, in January of 2022, the Chelsea Project is working hard to make rapid tests available and teaching everyone, especially the elderly and disabled, how to use them. Laura Holberger shows Grace McKinnon how to read that little strip from her rapid test.
So now what we're looking for here is one line or two lines.
Okay.
So you keep an eye on that for me.
Long time since I looked for one line or two lines.
Oh, it's like a pregnancy test. You've got that right, exactly.
Grace McKinnon also has lupus, a chronic autoimmune disease, putting her at higher risk. And this week, she's even more vulnerable.
In the last 2 weeks, have you been diagnosed with COVID-19?
No.
Have you been in close contact with anyone diagnosed with COVID-19?
Yes.
Yes, I'm sad to hear that.
Grace waits for her test results, but only for a few minutes.
You can see now that there's one line at the control. That means you're negative. Now,
that's
negative.
Okay. Yeah.
Two lines would be positive.
I love negative.
Yeah, so do I.
Grace plans to come back next week and the week after that for more free tests, as long as they're being offered. But without this resource in her building, Grace says she couldn't afford to buy weekly rapid tests. And waiting for a PCR test just isn't an option.
Well, the old-fashioned way is to go to a site, and usually the lines are long. And the problem is it's winter in Boston, okay? You're already going to a site where people suspect that they're sick. And the elders, those in wheelchairs, the young families with kids, how do they manage that?
Recall, the city of Chelsea suffered greatly in the first pandemic wave in 2020. It might be happening again with the Omicron variant. According to Massachusetts data, the city currently has the second highest positivity rate in the state. But catching COVID early is what health officials say will stop that spread. And that's exactly what happened with 23-year-old Chelsea resident Jorge Amaya.
At the beginning of this year, we all got COVID and many of us weren't showing any symptoms. Many of us just had a little cough. Me, I had a fever. I was the one showing the symptoms. Without those COVID tests, without the rapid COVID tests, my mom, for example, my aunt, they probably go out to do their regular daily basis things.
And like the majority of the workforce in Chelsea, Jorge's mom is an essential worker.
My mom is actually a lunch lady for the high school. So her catching COVID and her not showing those symptoms, is just imagine if she goes to school and then she's giving food to the students in Chelsea. She's a substitute for that. So she goes to both every single school in Chelsea. So she wasn't showing those symptoms. And then she could be spreading the virus to every single student in Chelsea. So just me having the COVID rapid test just prevented that from happening.
Chelsea City officials hope that with greater access now to these frequent rapid tests, Jorge's story can become the norm. But here's the thing, right? We are entering year three of this pandemic. The city of Chelsea reports that more than 12,000 people have had the disease so far, and hundreds have already died. So many people, like Alexandra Jimenez, who manages Grace McKinnon's building, are asking the obvious question.
I lost a lot of tenants. And when you work with the elderly, you become very attached to them. And I think if this would have been done when all this started, a lot of my tenants would be here. This should have been done from the beginning, I believe. I know it costs money and everything, but I think a lot of lives would have been saved.
While Chelsea, Massachusetts is moving forward now, the fact is, back in March 2020, in the earliest weeks of the pandemic, more lives could have been saved by the exact same kind of rapid test that Grace McKinnon used this week, and that the Biden administration says it will soon distribute nationwide. In fact, a COVID rapid test like that did exist back then. A cheap, at-home rapid test that provided results in just 15 minutes. But you never heard of that test in March of 2020, did you? I mean, neither did I. In fact, it never made it to the shelves, and we may have never known about it were it not for a remarkable report from ProPublica that headlined, "This scientist created a rapid test just weeks into the pandemic, and here's why you still can't get it." Well, that scientist joins us now, Irene Bosch. And besides being an MIT scientist, she's also an adjunct professor at Mount Sinai University in New York, and she's with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Bosch, welcome.
Hi, Meghna. Nice being with you. Thank you for having me. This is great.
So first of all, can you just reflect with me for a minute sort of your thoughts and feelings upon hearing, for example, the efforts going on in Chelsea right now to get rapid tests out? I mean, at least at this point in time, that's a positive development.
No, that we are so happy. We were working about almost 12 months to get the Chelsea project up and running. So we started with a group of scientists, including myself and others you heard in the mm-hmm. in the piece. And now it's happening, so this is wonderful. It wasn't easy. We're running this study for the next 4 months. We hope that it's an example to what we could do for the rest of the year. Yes.
Yeah. So tell me then, thanks to the reporting from ProPublica, it was completely a surprise to me mm-hmm. that you had developed a rapid test in March of 2020. So let's go back to the very, very, very beginning. What were you doing before this global pandemic was declared in 2020?
Yeah, no, this is a great question, because before, and this is even 10 years at the MIT with the Gerke lab, our team was developing exact same tests for Zika, dengue, chikungunya, of course, Zika hit us as well. 2016. So what I was doing was something so similar that when we were alerted of the pandemic early in February, we started to make a test for COVID. And the way we did it was to use the reagents that were from the COVID 2003. So thanks to those reagents, we put them together, we assembled the test, and we had it all done by April of 2020. So it's because of the prior experience doing very similar tests for other viral diseases.
Okay, so take me a little bit more into the science. When you say you had reagents from COVID 2003, what does that mean?
So most or almost all of the tests that you see today for the SARS-CoV-2 came from the high similarity with this, you know, brother or cousin 2003 SARS that we knew existed.
Okay.
That's why, because inside those tests, what you have is basically two reagents that they're called antibodies that catch the virus as they go through the little strip that people look at the lines forming. So basically those kind of magic components were actually inexistent, but also very, very few of them. So we searched really fast to see what we could do to assemble this test. And lo and behold, we talked to some companies in Asia, and that's how we made the test. Most of the tests today are actually made exactly the same way. So yeah, that's why we were able to do it so early, thanks to the similarity between SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2.
I see. Okay. So just to recap for folks who maybe have a little trouble keeping up with the science, back in 2003, there was the SARS outbreak. And so there you say we had reagents, or essentially the compounds needed for testing because of that. And you also have, of course, direct professional experience. You were saying coming up with tests for Zika and dengue fever as well.
Yes.
Okay. And so, so then the pandemic gets declared. And did you say it took you, what, a month to come up with the SARS-CoV-2 rapid test?
Yeah, so one of the things the team was doing is precisely telling, you know, the biotech industry that not only in the lab, but also producing this for commercial use was possible. That's why the company that we founded at that time did that proposition. So we took all the reagents from MIT to make dengue and Zika tests and have it as a commercial test, also chikungunya, and then for SARS, which was a completely new sort of monster, we had to go and knock at doors on people who already had their reagents from the 2003 cousin or related, and then we made our own antibodies to make tests.
Okay.
So that's what everybody did. All the FDA-approved tests were made later on that year with the reagents from Asia.
But we're talking about your development of tests in the March-April 2020 timeframe. And I mean, the test sounds exactly like what people are trying to use now. 15 minutes, looking for that little red line, $10 a piece. And your company said it could produce something like 100,000 of these tests per week in the spring of 2020. So, Professor Bosch, if you just stand by for a second, when we come back, I want to hear from you about why that didn't happen. So hang on for a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're speaking with Irene Bosch. She's a visiting scientist at MIT, also adjunct professor at Mount Sinai University in New York. But more importantly, back in the spring of 2020, during that first wave of the global COVID pandemic, she and her company developed a COVID rapid test. So this is almost 2 years ago, a COVID rapid test that never made it to shelves, and it could have been a game changer in the earliest days of the pandemic. Now, we learned about Professor Bosch from a fantastic piece of reporting in ProPublica headlined, "This scientist created a rapid test just weeks into the pandemic, and here's why you still can't get it." So tip of the hat to ProPublica. We've got a link to their story at onpointradio.org. So, Professor Bosch, you make this test based on your deep existing knowledge in rapid tests for other pathogens and, as you said, that connection to SARS. You turn to the FDA and you say, let's get this out there. What happened next?
Well, it is a process by which you need to validate the performance of the test. That we don't have any problem with. The problem was that back in the days, FDA set up certain standards that were perhaps too high or too different, too difficult to meet for any antigen test in existence. So we tried to show to FDA that there are ways in which we could certainly validate a test, because what happens is that viruses go from like a bell shape, from low to high to low. That's what happens in your days of infection, right? We all know that. So that right way perhaps to do it was to ask, could this test perform well in which part of the infection? But at that time, FDA did not do that. They did not consider that it's a moving target, the amount of virus. So they basically were setting up too high standards. And they ask, tell us how your test works regardless of the amount of virus. And of course, the test will work 80%, 70%. Mm. But you know what I'm saying? So it was at that time, FDA did not have, unfortunately, perhaps the proper way to ask how to validate tests.
Okay, I want to dive into the details here a little bit, because it was what, on March 21st, according to ProPublica, that you first submitted the test for emergency use authorization to the FDA?
Yeah, so we did a first submission in April, and it came back saying that, sorry, you cannot use laboratory tools to validate a test. You have to go and do this in hospitals. Oh my God. So we went ahead quickly, did it in three hospitals in Florida, and they apparently told us that that was the fastest clinical trial ever done by them. So by May, we had the data. So we showed that data to FDA, and they still said, no, it just doesn't perform well. But we explained that when you have very little virus, there's no way an antigen test will perform, even today, even the ones you find in the pharmacy. The trick was to keep testing and showing, as we did, that when you are at the peak or when you are well into your infection, which is day two or three, the test performed really well. So by August, we submitted again, and again, they said, no, well, we don't have a way to validate the test. You just have to, you know, per amount of virus, basically. So basically, we had to just show them the whole trial. And of course, if you take people at the very end of their PCR, which is called the technique we use, that almost doesn't have any virus in there.
Okay, right. So hang on here for a second. Every sentence that you utter, Professor Botch, is like full of fascinating information. So I'm going to go backwards a little bit. First of all, you said that you had initially validated the test through, I guess, laboratory testing. It makes sense to me that the FDA would come back to you and say, no, we need to see a little bit about how this works in the real world through those hospital clinical trials. But you did that very quickly.
Yes.
But when we say validate, though, for we lay people, what do you mean by that?
Sure. So let very good point. When FDA asks to validate a test, they have something called gold standard or something you compare it to. At that point, the very nimble rapid test, which detects viral proteins and viral presence, had to be validated with something called polymerase chain reaction, which is a very potent, and everybody knows it as PCR.
Yeah.
And that is a machine, it's a big, you know, it's a lot of reagents. And then, you know, many days later, they report back to the patient, right? So they wanted us to validate the rapid test against the PCR and say how many positives were PCR also positive with the test, how many negatives were also negative. And that's called sensitivity, specificity. So we did all that, right? And at that time, they wanted to be at 90%, meaning out of 10, 9 have to be catched by the rapid test. Uh-huh. Well, guess what? No test in the world does that. Sorry, it just doesn't happen. Because depending on, you mentioned that bell shape that you have your virus, right?
Okay, so I'm going to jump in here. I'm just going to jump in here for a second. So when you say that no test in the world catches, it depends on that viral load, essentially, in the individual that you're talking about.
Correct.
And so early on, it's just not high enough to catch it. For the rapid tests, is that same
early,
for
people? Yeah, so only the first day you could miss, and only the very few last day you could miss, which is about day 10. or day 12. Even okay. for Omicron, you have viruses until day 10 or 12.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the rapid test starts losing sensitivity, but by no means it's less sensitive when you have tons of viruses, like day 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. It's like 10 to the 9 viruses per like a
week. I see. So, but to put it simply, though, are you saying that the point is that the FDA was the bar they had set essentially was that yeah. the rapid test had to perform as well as the PCR tests?
Yeah, 90%, correct. And we told them that because of our experience in dengue, and we already knew that that's basically impossible to match with other viruses, right? But at that point, they say, look, these are rules. I mean, we understand FDA has to have rules, right? And then the next year, they went from 90% to 80% because they understood that the 90 was too high a bar.
I mean, uh-huh.
They would have... But Europe, in the same time, they have hundreds of tests available for 50 cents. Actually, we can make these tests for a really low price, like a dollar or less. And Europe was, I guess, smarter because they did allow validation through the lab, which is you take a protein that looks just like the virus, and then you tell the authorities, the regulatory agencies, how is the dilutions of that, and then that's it. So Europe was able to accept validations that did not include complex, lengthy, and costly clinical trials. Uh-huh.
Okay, so again, though, I mean, we're having this conversation in January of 2022. I want to, like, put our minds back into where we were in March, April, and May of 2020, mm-hmm. right? Because yeah. personally, for me, I didn't really, wasn't truly aware of even the possibility of rapid tests for this kind of pathogen until late into the summer when we interviewed, you know, Michael Mina, who you know well,
yes.
Formerly of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, who was he was pounding his fists on the table saying, we've got to get rapid tests out there to help people, you know we could stop maybe massive clusters or super spreaders. And I was like, what
yes.
is this rapid test? But again, so you're yes. saying that you could have had one out there long
yes.
before that.
Absolutely. And then the other thing that is so important to point out to that time, 2020, that now is widely understood, is the frequency. You don't do anything to control pandemics with PCR that you run once in a while. You have to have testing that goes frequently. And we knew that early in 2020. Why? Because more than 50% of people with COVID do not present symptoms. So nobody with no symptoms will go to a hospital. So we need to have a test that goes in the hands of all of us in our workplace or at home because we don't feel anything.
Yeah.
But yet we pass that virus to others. So the frequency of testing was the unlocking key for controlling pandemic. And FDA did not have such a monitoring test approval process. They only have diagnostics in hospitals. That's it.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, they have to be really strict, but they never had another mode of detecting virus.
Okay,
they
okay. did not. That is a very, very important point, and I want to come back to it. But I also just want to note that the first COVID test I took in 2020, I had to stick the swab halfway up my nose. I had to wait four days for that PCR test to come back. And so what we're saying here is we could have had those rapid tests that provided 15-minute results in that same time frame. What difference do you think that would have made?
Well, we project that would have been a huge difference because then we didn't have vaccination, which for sure protects people from Omicron or Delta or whatever SARS. It's not the same as being vaccinated than not being vaccinated. But remember, in 2020, we were not having vaccinations and people died in and out. People died every day. So having a rapid test is and was a lifesaver. So that's no doubt. Moreover, in 2020 than now, of course. Luckily now, because of the rate of vaccination is going up and up, and hopefully this year will be much higher than last year for United States, then we are not dying.
Mm.
We're not dying.
Professor Bosch, tell me what your conversations with FDA were like. I know there's all the documented conversations in terms of the testing and the requirements they sent back, et cetera. But when you got on the phone, which I presume that you did with FDA. Like, what was that like?
Yeah. So as you all know, FDA conversations with company are private, of course, for a good reason. But it's important that the public understand that these are very key to the public. And what happens is that FDA was actually trying hard to validate something, to put it on the market, but yet they were way too scared to do it in the wrong way. And they did not measure in the conversations I had. They were so scared because they're moving so fast. They were not perhaps thinking clearly through because, like, they didn't think, maybe, what if we have a test, compare a bicycle to a car? Why don't we have a bicycle that moves from point A to B? You don't need to have a super speed car to go from A to B. So they were not making sort of thinking outside the box. So to me, those conversations were kind of like surrounded with nervousness and a lot of sort of time pressure to respond. So it wasn't the best environment, I don't think. Well, hopefully but, with...
Yeah, Professor other, Bosch, yeah. Though, I mean, first of all, I want to underscore that I completely see how having your rapid test out there in 2020 would have been a game changer. And at the same time, I mean, we were in the throes of a once-in-a-century global pandemic that really no extant institution had had firsthand experience with right now, right? And so is it reasonable to have expected FDA to behave in a nimble way, willing to take the kind of risks that you're talking about, risks in their minds to move faster when we had all just like the tsunami had just sort of hit us. And I feel like all of society was still kind of in shock.
No, that's a great question, because these institutions like FDA, they're not built to react fast. So it's what we call a top to bottom approach. That's why we need the public. We need the Chelseas. We need everybody of us to show from bottom to up that there are other ways to do public health in which we participate. We have generated data, and then the FDA will react. So it is true that big institutions like that do not have the fastest way to react. They're not built that way. Maybe if we had a different administration, you know, maybe if we had a different kind of, you know, government opinions, that would have moved the needle, I think, because at that time, it was also very hard to have the administration say, oh, we don't even have a pandemic and things like that for a while. Well, so unfortunately, it impacts how FDA would have perhaps moved forward.
Okay, so let's keep that in mind, because later on I want to talk to you about how we prepare for the next pandemic. But, I mean, to your point, it was a different administration. It was the Trump administration. But now we're in the Biden administration, and we reached out multiple times to FDA to see if they could provide anyone, you know, the current interim director, if a spokesperson could come on the air with us. They would not provide anyone for this broadcast, but they did speak with us extensively on background. And in a formal statement, here's what FDA said to us. Regarding FDA review, the spokesman said, I want to be clear. If we received a home test that the data and science supported in early to mid-2020, we would have quickly authorized it. Unfortunately, many submissions to the FDA or the FDA has received for home tests include incomplete or poor data, and it's the FDA's responsibility to protect the public health by declining to authorize poorly performing tests without complete data. So that comes from the current administration.
Yeah, no, but they forgot to tell you that indeed they made a big change. They went from a 90% to an 80% validation bar. So yes, thank you, FDA. You are there to protect the public. We will not deny that. We were scientists. We will definitely know how important they are. But we do need to admit, and in my opinion, that nobody had tools to do the right thing, looking retrospectively. But they were, and they are, the regulatory agency. They could have been more comprehensive and have a test that goes into the hands of a lot of people with less sort of sensitivity to PCR. And it would have been fantastic. Moreover, this last year, 2021, we and others published in JAMA, a journal, that if you test consecutively, more than one day, you do day one, day two, and even day three, you reach 100% of the PCR. But those ideas, unfortunately, did not come from FDA. They could have. They could have said, guess what? Let's just do your test multiple days. You know, so we all have to learn. And I'm not saying, you know, probably they were doing the best they could, but we also have to admit that could have been better. Yes, could have been better because the test existed and it did not have a chance to be in the market.
Yeah. Okay. But so we spoke extensively with FDA on background, and an FDA official told us, acknowledged what you just said, that their performance recommendations now are 80% versus that 90% you were talking about. But it's a little confusing because this official also told us that the FDA has always had lower accuracy recommendations for rapid antigen tests versus PCR.
No, that's not accurate. I mean, or at least it's partially explained to you, unfortunately, because not only that they didn't have the same threshold for validation, but they didn't even allow us to put the PCR values. They did not allow the what we call the low to high to low spectrum. They just said, send us a whole bunch of patients regardless of whether they're high or low. So unfortunately, it was not as straightforward as they explained to you in your statement.
Well, Professor Irene Bosch, stand by for just a moment. So much more to learn from you. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Irene Bosch. She's a visiting scientist at MIT, an adjunct professor at Mount Sinai University in New York. And we were alerted to her tremendous work in the early days of the pandemic by a terrific article in ProPublica. And we have a link to that article at onpointradio.org. And we're asking really broadly here, what difference could have been made in April, May, or June of 2020 if the COVID rapid test that Professor Bosch and her company had developed made it onto shelves? Now, Professor Bosch, before we turn more pointedly towards where we are now, I just want to ask you a couple more questions of what continued to unfold across 2020. First of all, as I understand from ProPublica's reporting, it was all the way into October that you still hadn't received FDA approval for your rapid test in 2020. Is that right?
That's right.
And why was that?
Well, we've worked so hard to meet the requirements of FDA. What happened is that all of a sudden, we were like, you know, back and forth conversations. And all of a sudden, there's a message that says you have 48 hours to respond, you know, eight things. So we said, wait, where's this clock coming now? And then if you didn't have all the answers in the 48 hours that they gave you, they basically put you in zero, meaning you have to reopen the submission. Each submission takes minimum of 90 days. For just getting a response from the FDA. So they told us there were a total of four submissions done. It's not just one. And they closed the most important one, which was the home use, because the whatever clock started. So nobody alerted us that there will be a clock all of a sudden. So there were internal changes within the FDA for whatever reason. They were probably overwhelmed and that. You know, completely sidetracked all the huge efforts we were doing. And again, it's a small company. We depended on that commitment to have a test approve.
Yeah. Okay. And so they closed your application, essentially.
Yeah. So basically, they not only that, they even closed applications that were, that we also put through for PCRs and other methods. And when I got letters, they would say something like, well, your test is not anymore needed. But it was needed, like when I started applying. So FDA had all sorts of issues, not just with one company, with many, many companies, to the point that there are super good tests right now. Why do we say that? Because we took a bunch of tests, like 10 different tests, and compare them with an EUA approved one, the emergency use. And we have ways in the lab to compare tests. And we know that they're identically to so similar to the ones approved yet. And those owners of those other tests are so scared of even putting their applications through, even today, because it's so harsh for FDA to welcome those applications.
So there was a parallel track of testing development in 2020 regarding PCR, right? And so when your application to FDA was essentially closed in, what, October or thereafter, in the fall of 2020,
yes,
that prevented you from, you know, getting the investors that you needed to really ramp up production of your tests. I understand that. But again, hat tip to ProPublica, they note that in 2020, there was a $600 million federal effort through the NIH to get PCR tests out there. Was there a similar kind of push from the federal government for rapid tests?
Not then. Maybe now, but then absolutely no. So we went to two applications of the RADx program in NIH, and they were given to molecular testing, which is RNA-based detection, but not to necessarily antigen testing. There are maybe one or two exceptions to this, but by and large, antigen tests were not seen as the game changer. Soon after that, in 2021 and today, absolutely the panorama is different. Europe uses them, Asia uses them. So now USA needs to understand that these tests are super available today in millions per month. I mean, they're like huge amounts that we could buy them today. And hopefully that will help us navigate the next year of the pandemic.
Mm.
But back then, no.
Okay. So let's move forward into 2021 then. Here is Dr. Anthony Fauci testifying before a congressional committee in March of 2021, saying at that time he wanted to, quote, flood the system with at-home testing.
I actually have been saying that for months and months and months, that we should be literally flooding the system with easily accessible, cheap, not needing a prescription, point of care, highly sensitive and highly specific. And that, in fact, you're going to be seeing more of that soon.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, in March of 2021, Professor Bosch, did we see more of that soon?
Well, I hope. Anthony Fauci could be heard every single day, every hour, because what he says is true, meaning he's such a knowledgeable person. He's a virologist and scientist, and he knows that this is a game changer. So what needs to happen is to open the importation of really good tests that exist in Asia and Europe. And that's even a mandate or an FDA mandate that would say all the good tests from Europe, please come into this country. That's all it takes. It takes like 1 hour to have that legislation. I don't know what it is, like a rule. Open the gate. And that's exactly what Anthony Fauci is saying.
Okay,
like,
I probably wasn't as clear as I should have been. So when he said this in 2021, you know, advocating for access of at-home testing, He concluded that little bite we said with, we will be seeing that soon in March of 2021. I mean, but I don't recall the system being flooded with rapid tests in the spring of last year.
Well, of course, because the what he's saying, Dr. Fauci's saying, is that he recommends that in 2021. Thank God, right? He actually said it in 2020, but people were not hearing. So what needs to happen, and maybe it has not happened, but hopefully happens soon, is that the Biden administration opens and allows the very good tests already in Europe and Asia to come into United States. and at the same time allowed local production, because we can make this death back and forth in millions in the United States. So in the meantime, the most pressing point is to allow the pests from Asian Europe that perform so well to enter the United States territory. Right now, you cannot. Even if you try to buy 1,000 tests, they'll be stopped in import-export office of the FDA. You cannot get them in to the United States.
I just don't understand why that is.
Unless you have an FDA, unless you have the FDA mandate that allows it to come in, and they say to protect our public, but they're already well shown to protect the rest of the world. So all they need to understand that these are tests that protect the public in Europe, that protect the public in Asia, and they will be validated really easy. It would take maybe a day to validate a test, to tell the truth, in the lab, and clinically as well. In Chelsea, we're doing that as well. So if we could have the attention of the Biden administration to allow the entry of really good tests today, January 13, we will make the change that was announced in the 2021 March. So we need to do that. Otherwise, there's no time to, I mean, we need to do that. We need to also allow all these USA, EUA approvals that are stuck, that are really good. I mean, so a couple of very simple things.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is absolutely sparking my curiosity, let me tell you, Professor Bosch. So I think we might spend some time a bit later trying to understand what's preventing the FDA from validating those international tests and allowing importation. But let's talk for a second about what the FDA has been saying. I mean, just this week in a Senate hearing, Acting FDA Commissioner Dr. Janet Woodcock told the Senate committee that her office is taking steps and has taken steps to shorten review times for over-the-counter rapid tests.
Increasing access to accurate, rapid, at-home tests continues to be a priority for FDA. Since I last testified, the agency's authorized 4 additional over-the-counter at-home tests, bringing the total number to 15. And the agency continues to prioritize the review of these type of tests. We also partnered with the NIH to establish ITAP, which streamlines validation and authorization of antigen tests with potential for large-scale manufacturing. We expect shorter review times for such EUA requests due to our partnership with ITAP. In fact, the first 2 tests that participated in this program were authorized in 2 days or less from the time FDA received the final data.
So that's Acting FDA Commissioner Dr. Janet Woodcock in a Senate hearing this week. Professor Irene Bosch, that sounds like progress to my ear. What do you think?
That sounds like progress. We, like I said before, because we know with the Chelsea program, we have 5 companies that are afraid of even putting their FDA through application, that because of those words and that encouragement, that's fantastic, because we should see at least 5 different companies being approved in 2 days. And if that is the truth, then we will see that. Now, right now, today, we yet not have witnessed that, but it doesn't mean that it would not happen. Could be that this is a game changer, absolutely. So if we see a 2-day approval process for an antigen test at home, I'll be that would be the happiest day in the last 2 years for me, because I've been doing this in and out every day.
You know, we're getting a lot of comments online here. Sybil Kim says, just returned from holiday to Germany, where Sybil bought an over-the-counter COVID rapid test for a fraction of the cost that she would pay in the United States. For a box with 2 tests, she just paid €5. There's a couple of other comments that are coming in. I'd love to hear from you about this, because I think there's still a lot of, I know there's still a lot of questions around the reliability of the rapid test. For example, we have a listener, Shannon Cox, who's saying rapid tests are less reliable, so a false positive would have made her life rather difficult. Respond to that.
Yeah, so there are many ways in which we could fix those comments regarding the false positive rate. So what we found out is that if you repeat the test, if you actually buy 3 tests, and you do day 1, 2, and 3, you reach the same sensitivity as a PCR and you're at home and you can protect your people immediately around you. That is the fact. This is the science behind this. If you have certain people very much like 1 in 200 or even less, certain tests will pop a false positive, meaning you have a line when and that line is super faint, but you don't really have the virus. So there are ways to mitigate this. Either you repeat the test. Nowadays, if you had like Germany that has 40 different labels, get another label because each label is like a different Band-Aid, like, you know, the Johnson & Johnson and this and that. So you can use whatever you want. So a positive test will be always positive with various testings that you use. But a false positive will pop completely negative, right? If you just change to a different test. So if we had in our hands a lot of options, that caller would be much at ease. But first of all, we don't even know how to buy tests this day, so let alone get a false positive.
Well, there's sort of still layers of complication and perhaps not even adequate trust around the rapid test, not just from individuals, but from, you know, employers more largely. I mean, we had mentioned the Chelsea Project, of course, which you helped set up a little earlier. And when our producer went out to do the reporting there, when Paige went out, she also spoke with other people. For example, the Department of Public Health in Chelsea, their head there, Flor Amaya, says part of the problem is that when people come up as positives with the rapid tests in Chelsea, their employers still need confirmation with PCR. So it kind of limits the sort of public health effect that the rapid test could provide. Yeah. What do we do about that?
That's, it's so unfortunate because, again, it's misinformation. For a health department to be asking for a PCR that doesn't even exist, right?
Yeah, no, but the health department is asking. She's saying that, like, when Chelsea residents use
employers.
Their employers are saying, no, you have to do a confirmatory PCR.
Sure. I mean, employers, right? Yeah. All of them. Employers to ask for that is not realistic. Number one, it takes days to get one. Number two, you don't even have them anywhere. Number three, they cost money if you don't have insurance. So it's a false expectation that you need a PCR to confirm a test. Maybe when you're validating the test and you're doing a clinical trial, but once you know that this test, you test 1 or 2 days and you have a positive, you're positive. I mean, I'm sorry, but if you pop positive in an antigen test more than 1 day, you're definitely positive. Mm. With Omicron, even now we're seeing that some people will have early symptoms, which did not happen in the Delta. So in Omicron, people are feeling sick right away.
Yeah.
So those are feeling sick. So what I'm saying is that asking for a PCR, it's unrealistic. I understand, but it's not applicable really across the board.
Oh, gosh, I wish I had another hour with you, Professor Bosch, but we only have a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And my last question to you really has to do with moving forward, because it still seems like perhaps even at the FDA still, there's almost this like medical silver bullet approach versus a public health approach to early pandemic management.
Yes.
Has that mindset changed enough? And do you think the FDA can be more nimble? And we have about 30 seconds, I'm afraid.
Well, the next pandemic. So I would say that my closing remark is that it will depend on the public push. We saw that happening with HIV drugs. It's when the public became part of a solution. So I do thank NPR for making more awareness. And I do invite the public to push for much more better public health for all of us. So that's what I would say.
Well,
it's in our hands. Yeah. Let's work with that.
Professor Irene Bosch, visiting scientist at MIT, adjunct professor at Mount Sinai University in New York, and the scientist featured in ProPublica's story about how she created a rapid test in March and April of 2020, but she still can't get it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
And folks, we've got a link to ProPublica's story at onpointradio.org. And again, we did reach out to the FDA to join us live during this broadcast. They declined but sent us a statement. This is On Point.